This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Welcome, doctors, for the first episode of 2021. How did your new year go?
Cool. Went fine. How about yourself, Jen?
Yeah, it was good. Very chill. Very, very quiet and chill here in Maui.
Last year, you and I were listening to your brother in a big rock concert.
Yeah, that was very 2019 of us to be out of an enclosed, crowded space, like, yeah. You know, with lots of other people in our personal space. But yeah, that was a very cool show at the Fox Theater in Oakland. That was super fun.
Second.
Yeah, very different experience this year.
Yeah, just so everybody knows, I have now been to two rock concerts as a result of that. One was 20 years ago, another open whack job chick took me to Marilyn Manson.
Oh, wow.
That is more legit than my brother's band.
Your brother's band is a absolute rock band. Or what do you call them? What kind of music is that anyway?
I think they're just alt rock.
Yeah.
Aren't they
like some kind of new wave, this, that? Isn't there a name for them?
I don't know. He'd probably be super offended by my inability to properly genre them.
Right.
But,
so you better not go on record.
Generally when they... Yeah, no. But he's... they generally... I mean, they're kind of like a jam band.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You could call them that. That was sort of their history. You know, mm-hmm. They're mostly a touring band.
Yeah.
They're called Portugal the Man for anybody who doesn't know and who's confused by this whole conversation. So mm-hmm. they, for just, you know, basically since they got together in high school for mm-hmm. decades, they just toured around and they played festivals and, you know, these big kind of hippie festivals. And mm-hmm. and so they're very, like, they have... That is their bread and butter, and then they stumbled onto this giant hit that actually climbed the pop charts. So they, you know, a lot of people consider them a pop band or like just a typical pop band, but they, I think they would consider themselves more alternative, whatever
yeah.
that means anymore.
Alternative rock, something.
Indie alternative. Yeah.
Got mm-hmm. it. Okay.
Yeah, and that was, they always expect to do pretty well on those charts. And so when they started like climbing the Billboard pop chart, they were, you know, in the same, they were top 10 at the same time as like Justin Bieber and, you know, Beyonce.
Yeah.
So I think they were a little taken aback by it. But
yeah.
they, because they are a jam band, they put on an amazing show. You know, they mm-hmm. always open with some Metallica covers, and they have a big light show and lots of cool animations that go on the monitor. And it was such a big, great, high energy crowd that night, and mm-hmm. with the New Year's Eve energy and everything, it's mm-hmm. like feels like a million years ago after the whole 2020 experience.
It does.
We just feel sort of like, oh yeah, this is cool. We're just hanging out in the green room, and then we're gonna rock out in the venue, and yep, this is life. And then nope, go to your corners and don't come out for the rest of the year.
Oh my.
Doctor,
all right.
Did you have a favorite song when you listened to Portugal the Man last year?
Oh, I only know one of their songs. Dun, 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 dun.
That's actually pretty good. I recognize that. Did you have a favorite song when you listened to Marilyn Manson by any chance?
I did not know a single song. It was just this wall of, it all sounded the same for 2 hours.
did you wear a wig or grow your hair out by any chance?
No, but I did intelligently bring things to put in my ears. So that was a really good move.
Your anti-disagreeable earplugs, I see.
Okay. Yeah.
Marilyn Manson is super hardcore. I'm impressed. I went to some, like, you know, I saw some pretty impressive metal shows when I lived in Germany. So yeah. I probably could top you with, you know, obscure Swedish metal. But in the States, I haven't been to anything that awesome. So
yeah,
all due deference. Well,
it's quite clearly, a display.
Clearly, that chick was a more open whack job than I am.
Well, because all the young kids at these shows, like, they'll see you there. They're like, oh my God, this guy's been going to these concerts forever.
Yeah.
Like the super fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Thank
what
you.
What did you do, Nathan? What was your New Year's? Would you, your adventures consist of?
Oh, it wasn't a lot of adventure, actually. So my family has a little dance party every year. But because this year my grandmother passed away, who was a big driving force behind that, we kind of all decided just to not do the dance party and just play some board games, share stories about her. And so I went and joined my family for that. And my mom had this really hilarious game. My mom is like the queen of finding party games to do with a group of people. And one of these things is she told everybody, before you come, bring 3 articles of random clothing from your house, bring it here. And so when we all finished dinner, she did like a musical chairs, but everyone passed this garbage bag full of clothing. And when the bag stopped at you, you had to randomly reach in, quickly pull out an article of clothing and put it on. So within like 30 minutes of all this music playing, everyone's laughing, and, you know, people have gotten tutus, bras, panties, sweatpants, wildly colored hats, and, you know, shirts and clothing all over themselves. And it was a pretty fun night. So
that's creative. Never heard of that one before. Cool.
That's awesome. Sounds like a very exciting party game.
Yeah. All right. Well, tell us a story, Nathan. What questions do we have?
Well, today's first question has to do with the American government. It was a question in response to Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle's analysis of the 2020 election. But honestly, since then, I have not kept up with very much politics. All I know is that there's something going on today in the Capitol. And so I have no idea other than that, other than there's a little bit of drama going on. I mean, that's really all I know. So what I decided is just put that question first and see if you guys felt like winding out on the current situation. Great. And then the next couple of questions are about ego trap and pleasure trap, and then about dating and essentially living life past your 50s or 60s. A listener actually was crushed to hear Dr. Lyle say he's dead from an evolutionary perspective. So we wanted to.
Oh, he didn't mean that.
All right. Well, tell us the first question.
All right. Dear doctors, on your episode about the 2020 election, I was very surprised to hear. I was very surprised to hear the two of you lionize the sturdiness of American government. When one of the central problems in American life, diet-related disease, is so largely attributable to lobbying. If government can be bought, how am I supposed to buy the idea of a reliable government?
Well, I could say plenty, but Jen, you're our Harvard PhD in political science, so what say you?
The irony, of course, anytime we get a political question like this is that I always have to just say I every day I'm a little more kind of withdrawn from the fray. You know, I have been paying some attention today. We're recording this on the much anticipated January 6th for people who are listening. And I mean, I it's a heck of a day to not be on Twitter. I will say that. Mm-hmm. So I've been totally white knuckling it because I'm aware that there's, some significant excitement. It looks like these photos coming out look like scenes of, you know, when Yeltsin fired on his own parliament, you know, the sort of like the smoke and people climbing the walls and people getting shot and killed. I mean, this is the stuff of not the United States. So it's pretty exciting, to say the least. Probably a bad choice of words, but it's really something to behold. But I do think that at the end of the day, it really makes our point for us when we were talking about the overall stability of the government and of checks and balances and sort of the ship righting itself over the long haul, where, you know, you have... you have this mob descend on the Capitol and force evacuations and you know, create absolute chaos for a day. But the wheel will continue to turn and the process will continue to work. And you've got McConnell looking like an absolute statesman today. So you've got people being thrown into these roles that we couldn't have anticipated, just because the center does hold at the end. So, you know, for the question about lobbying, of course, lobbying is a huge, it's part of the system. It's just kind of part of how the system operates. And there's, of course, you know, the degree to which any particular lobby has influence at any particular time is going to be more significant than their opponent, and it's going to matter who's in power, and it's going to matter who has their ear, and it moves back and forth. The government is not bought in the sense that you're talking about it, where you have an oligarchy that is serving very particular corporate interests, that you have an oligarchy that is serving vacillating corporate interests. Mm-hmm. You have an oligarchy that at any given time is in the pocket of one interest or another interest, and that interest is changing all the time depending who's in power, and who's in power is still subject to a fundamentally fairly competitive democratic process. So yes, of course you have an intersection between money and power in Washington, but that's nothing new. That's been the case from the very beginning. And no one has a unilateral, indefinite hold on that connection between money and power. And so it's not comparable to what you see in other countries that are dealing with problems where, you know, those two things are fused in a much more significant and permanent way. So it doesn't mean that it's no big deal and that we shouldn't worry about it and that we shouldn't try to, create protections and defenses against it as much as is reasonable. But it's not something that I'm going to use to dismiss the entire system as, not serving the interests of the American people and only serving the corporations. I just don't think that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr. Hawk, do you think if there was a perfect system and there was no sort of corruption or, you know, lobbying sorts of problems, that people wouldn't get into the pleasure trap anyway?
Oh. No, I mean... That's no, of course, people are going to find their way into the pleasure trap as long as the food is available. So, I mean, you could make an argument about, commodity subsidies and how inexpensive the pleasure trap food is, how widely available it is compared to where it used to be. But I think we would have seen an explosion in that. Look at other sort of well consolidated democracies across the world. Are we going to accuse them of being just as much bought and paid for when they have very comparable levels of obesity? I mean, this is just a function of wealth more than anything else. It's just general wealth, general abundance. The fact that nobody in the developed world is starving to death anymore, for the most part, not the way that it used to be. And so, yes, you've got some issues that make it more readily available, even cheaper. But I think that that is all part of the broader system that's made everybody richer and given them more access to more food in general.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Dr. Lau, what say you?
Yeah, well, again, just to put it simply, the fiasco of the American diet has nothing to do with the United States government. Yet that's a sideshow about what specific producers happen to be connected to power at any given one time. But it's, as Jen talks about, it's a shifting process all over the place. And it has actually nothing to do with it. If the government did not play $1 in that game at all, if there was no USDA or nothing of the kind, it would look very much like it looks now. So it would be indistinguishable in terms of its health outcomes. So I know that people like to think that somehow. I know. I got a good friend of mine, Colin Campbell, is very thinking as if the government has any influence, because when you get down in the weeds, it looks like it does, because you can see, oh well, big bunch of money is going to the dairy farmers, so therefore we get more of that, but. that is not what's happening. It's just making it more lucrative for those people to produce. It's not making it, that isn't the cause of the reason for the dietary choices of this species. So that just means that a specific set of producers or companies winds up benefiting. So yes, when you get down to the weeds, you can see that at close range that there's all kinds of graft and corruption and completely uninterested government with respect to public health outcomes. Of course, that's true. But it wouldn't make any difference if it weren't. In other words, if the government were incredibly interested in health outcomes, they wouldn't have any influence. Try it. You know, give it a shot for yourself. In other words, see if you can figure out how it, to incentivize your 19-year-old with every allowance that you can. You know, your 19-year-old that eats shit with both hands, works at Dunkin' Donuts, and is 40 pounds overweight, and you desperately want them to get their act together. See what you can do to incentivize them to not do that. Good luck. Okay, you won't have any influence. So the notion that the governments could influence people away from the pleasure trap is a joke. Now, with that being said, wait, go ahead, Jen.
I was just going to bring up the cigarette example. You know, yeah. I think a lot of people have the intuition that it's the, you know, taxes on tobacco were the thing that made people stop smoking, instead of the fact that it just became progressively banned everywhere,
right.
And increased the channel factors for people to light up on their you know, their break at work.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not going to go all the way downstairs and go to all the trouble. I mean, that's really the driver of the diminished smoking rate in this country, much more than taxation is. So I think people have that story in mind when they're thinking about, oh, well, maybe we couldn't incentivize, you know, healthier outcomes, but we could use the stick. We could just increase taxes, soda taxes, whatever else. So it tends to usually go that direction, but I think that is not very well based on the evidence that we have from the tobacco example.
Right.
Plus they subsidize tobacco farmers with that same money, don't they?
Let me see. So anyway, that's what I think in terms of the general robustness of the government. I think the United States government is an incredible creation, and I think that I think we're designed by nature to be very sensitive to in-group out-group dynamics with respect to this, and to also believe that our inputs into the situation are significant and important. That's because you were designed by nature for a Stone Age troop with 30 people in it, 30 adults. And between you and your sister and your brother-in-law and your best friend and his wife, that was like five of those people. So that means you had a lot of say in whether we go east or west for the winter. And so if you want to go east because you think that's the best idea and some other people want to go west, your political vocalizations and your political machinations are important to an outcome that's important for you. That your notice how heated it can get at your own, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, because you're trying to influence people close to you, and it can be very frustrating if they don't see the things the way you see them, and it feels, quote, important. That is a delusion and a misunderstanding, a derivative of Stone Age psychology. The truth is that you're one in, you know, 330 million people, and nobody really cares one way or another. Your vote makes absolutely no difference. I mean, you can say, well, you get to vote, which is cool, but you know, all of your political influence is adding up to almost nothing with respect to any outcome with respect to your life. So that fact that's true, and that we have as good a system as we do, is an incredible blessing. So that the major key to your better future is you, and it's got nothing to do with anything that goes down in politics. So that is the beauty of the United States government. Is literally the greatest beauty is that it functions quite well at all the things it's supposed to do. Of course, it's corrupt and overly expensive. That goes without saying. But the beauty of it is that you really don't have to worry about it, because it's hardly relevant at all to your existence. That's fantastic. And that's always been true. When I sit down at any month of the year, since I was an adult for the last 40 years, at some restaurant, if we ever get to go again, with friends of mine, we are not talking about, gee, in Washington today, this is what happened in the Congress, and oh my God, what's so-and-so going to do about this, and then, oh my God, what if that happens? Uh-uh. Only around election time are people interested. The rest of the time, if I'm talking to my friends, we're talking about our lives. We're talking about people we know, people that we like, people that we're trying to get to know, things that we're trying to accomplish. In other words, we're not like maybe somebody in Hong Kong right now that has to be unbelievably worried about governmental processes. We don't.
And that's the thing. I mean, that's why I beat this drum all the time, is people love to talk about, oh, how terrible American government is and how corrupt and how bought and paid for and how, you know, you can't, it's not a fair fight to get your interests represented in Washington or whatever. Okay, well, yeah, go anywhere else in the world where it really is, often a matter of life and death as to who's in power and who has control and whether they are your in-group or not.
Yeah.
Just to make your way around, you have to bribe petty little officials at every little random border check on some mountain road when you're taking the bus from one end of Guatemala to the other. You know, just anywhere. I mean, I have been in so many places where you were confronted with the absolute, just, you know, non-functional institutional environment of a government that is incredibly corrupt, that is incredibly in service to one set of entrenched interests and is highly militarized. And you have to walk that line or you are out. And it's a whole different game. It's a very different existence. And you bet those people sit around in cafes and talk about politics because it's incredibly relevant to their existence and to their life. And we have the same little circuit because again, it was same in the Stone Age. I mean, Stone Age politics were not exactly democratic either. they were strong men and bullies and thugs who were trying to seize power and oppress the people they didn't like. That is kind of the situation normal for political life. And so the fact that we have managed to create this system that is as neutral as it is and that really does most of the time in general act on the behalf of the greater good and, you know, one nation under the flag. Like, it's remarkable. It's a remarkable experiment. There are some imitators, but nothing quite like it. And so I just always want people to stand back and realize that it's a really, really precious thing.
Yeah. All grand, Jen, by the way, try to speak a little more directly into your mic because you're kind of, it's kind of highly variant how clear you are.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm trying to fix the problem where it's been too direct into my mic before. So
okay.
Yeah. Well,
like that's really good right there.
Okay. Yeah, I just moved it. So
good.
That's
good.
Better.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. All right, Nathan.
Well, Dr. Hawk, go ahead. Dare I say, amen, and maybe a women to that. All right. Our next question.
All right.
There you go.
Let's go on.
Oh, wait, Dr. Hawk, did I trigger you? What happened?
What happened?
Super triggered. Hashtag triggered. Yeah. Gonna have to process it in blank slate therapy this week.
All right. What do we got, Nathan?
Our next question. Dear doctors, how do people like the Esselstyns, Dr. Campbell, and others not fall into the ego trap regarding plant-based eating?
Yeah. Well, The ego trap is a situation where the expectations of either yourself, either from yourself, from an internal audience, or the external environment, has set the expectations above your level of abilities, and then you can feel intimidated by that, and then you can go against that in a self-destructive way, in order to demonstrate that you are not trying. These people, this is not impossible to escape the pleasure trap and its force. Lots of people do it. And so it's not trivial, and most people won't. But these people are all very intelligent people, and they're very conscientious individuals. And so as a result, you know, I'm sure it wasn't trivial for them, but it to get out of the pleasure trap. But neither was it some draconian, impossible dream. And so they did it. Big deal. There's nothing ego trap about it. It's not ego trapping for Michael Jordan to go out there and get 20 points on an average night in his career. It's a remarkable performance for an average NBA player, and it's a noteworthy performance in their careers, the night that they got 20. But for Michael, it was no big deal, and it's no big deal for these people. They understand deeply the importance for their own lives, and they've made the changes. They've gone up the learning curves. They have tremendous family support, and it's no big deal.
Yeah, I think that you do see ego trap behavior, you know, maybe not at that status tier that mm-hmm. we're talking about with this question, but with people who have just discovered the good word and they're trying it out, and maybe they've had some initial success and they decide that they are going to now be the great ambassador in the face of how to lose weight through plant-based eating and everything, and they start a YouTube channel, or they start to build some kind of following on social media that basically puts them into the ego trap. I think that happens quite often, and so you know, they will build up these high expectations in the right. in the village of their success, and then they run into some trouble after that initial yep. momentum that they have, which is very normal, which almost everybody yes. has. So there's a tendency to have that very enthusiastic, you know, beginning to the process, yes. Put people into the ego trap. It's one of the reasons that we tell people to cool it on the evangelism, just mm-hmm. within their own kind of social circle. Cause a lot of people find plant-based living and they want to, you know, spread the good word to everybody they know, and they can be pretty pushy about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hold on a second. Just, you know, give it 6 months, give it a year, give it 2 years, and watch as you can't imagine it now in the pink cloud of your early success, but you're going to struggle most likely, mm-hmm. unless you're a conscientious freakazoid like Alan Goldhammer. Mm-hmm. But you're going to struggle. You're going to backtrack. You're going to go through this process that almost everybody does, which is that sometimes you're doing really well and sometimes you're not doing so well. And you're feeling a little embarrassed and a little ashamed of your process. And if you've set it up like you are the expert and you know everything, and you know, everybody check me out and look at me as I tell you how to do this, that can be a very ego trap initiating kind of sequence for people. Yeah. And if they've linked career expectations to it, that right. gets pretty gnarly in a hurry.
Yeah, that's great, Jen. I was taking the question at face value, but I'm sure that the underlying question was at, you know, one notch of fame down. mm-hmm. Yeah, because there it's yeah. real. There it's real.
It's yeah. super real. Yeah. yeah.
All right. Good, Nathan. Wonderful. Now what
thank
do we God. Got?
Thank you. All right, our next question. Dear doctors, would you do a show addressing dating between men and women who are past their baby-making years, those in their 50s and 60s or older who are widowed or divorced? As a 62-year-old widow, it seems that most men just want something casual with no commitment. I want a committed partner. Any advice?
That's a Doug question.
I guess the reason I get a roar out of that is how classic is that? The woman wants a committed relationship and the guy just wants something casual. Of course. The answer, guess what? It's been that this way since you were 16. Okay, so nothing has changed. So you're up against the same, exactly the same process as you've always been. Which is the men are going to be interested in things casual unless it turns out to be an offer so good that the match is so good for him that he, quote, wants a commitment, okay, because he feels like it's special and he wants to officially or unofficially get rid of all the competition. And so that's what a committed relationship isn't a decision of commitment. It's a realization that it's in one's best interest, and it's run by an unconscious Stone Age built algorithm. That's what it is. It's the cost-benefit analysis saying, I'm willing to go all in and make long-term plans with this girl because this is a screaming deal for me, and that's what I want to do. That's a male committing. A male committing isn't, gee, you know, I'd really like things casual, but if I was a good guy, you know, in a way I'm supposed to do it, about what people say I'm supposed to do and what the Cosmopolitan front, you know, cover said that I'm supposed to do, or she's doing this or that to get a commitment out of me and taking me to therapy or whatever. That's a joke. Okay. You are committed to anything, a career, a friend, a concept, idea, project, or romantic partner. You're committed to the extent that your cost benefit analysis arrives at the conclusion that that's the right frame of mind to have towards it. So, yeah, nothing has changed. You got the same problem that you always had, and we got the same competitive problems that you always have, except that the people that we're looking at now aren't 22, 32, 42, or 52, or even 62. If you're 62, yeah, there'll be some people. What did she say she was, 62?
62-year-old widow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 62. Your market is late 50s into the 60s, et cetera. Maybe even a handsome, competent, healthy 72-year-old. That's probably in the game. But that's the marketplace. And most of those people are going to be looking for, quote, casual, non-committed relationships. And my attitude would be, you know, you can advertise easily that it's not a new ad for males to hear that women are interested in long-term relationships. Like that, every guy knows this. So you're going to go through your process, 10 paid dates, and let's see who's there standing at the end. That's how we're going to find out, you know, what's available in terms of committed partners. Mm-hmm. Jen?
Dr. Huck, yes.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything new to add to that. I mean, it's really, you see it at every stage. I mean, I remember my dear grandmother talking about the sort of romantic politics at the senior center in Anchorage with, you know, the sort of all the ladies had their eye on some, you know, 91-year-old, and he had a little flirtation with the frisky 79-year-old, and he wasn't ready to commit to the 85-year-old. It was like this jealousy. There was even discussion about how the younger woman who was at least in her late 70s, she may have been in her early 80s, because my grandmother would have been, you know, mid 80s at this point. That she was flashy, you know, she was a little bit
Poor.
Of a heart, you know, she was showing some cleavage, she had some, you know, she was bedazzled. And it's exactly the same story. Yep. It's like you could have transplanted it to a high school environment and it would have been right at home. So the animal does not change its stripes no matter what phase of life it happens to be.
You know what? Mabel's wearing too much red lipstick and it's not fair.
Totally. That was it. Well, and then because it's not fair, I guess I better wear more red lipstick too so I can be more competitive.
I love it. I love it. My mother, who's 87, I was watching TV and some Match.com derivative came on. It was, I don't know, was it Our Time or some older thing. Totally aiming at my market, by the way. And my mother looks at the thing and says, I think I should do that. It's like, well
yeah.
First we got to decide whether or not you could walk around the block. That's first we're gonna see if we're gonna figure that out when the weather gets warmer. Then we'll see.
You need to walk around the block to flirt.
Well, I guess not.
You could just sit there and wear your lipstick and be right. Charming and look pretty, which your mom is very good at. But your mom is a really interesting example because, you know, she's as she progresses in her Alzheimer's, you see like the actual algorithm of that brain is consistently obsessed with how attractive she is.
Yes.
You know, she's sort of like, she always returns to, do I look okay? You know, I can't go out without my lipstick on. Like she can't keep track of a conversation from, you know, 20 seconds months ago, but she always goes back to these questions of, and, you know, asks if her husband was handsome and all these kinds of things like that, that are very, like, you just really see what's actually the core motivational algorithm in that brain. Always concerned about what she's wearing, always concerned about whether there are going to be attractive men there. I've heard her be sort of dismissive of the men of her age that are available at the senior center or whatever. She's like, oh no, not those guys, you know, like those guys are a bore.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It actually is an amazing thing to watch. As Jen says, you see the personality coming out, and then you see it's stripping everything down to these core motivations. And what's ironic about it is that my mother, to the best of my knowledge, was absolutely not particularly at all concerned about her appearance, you know, in her... I knew her well from the time I was, 12 or so. So she would have been, you know, 40-ish. 40, 50, 60, 70, you don't see it. You see a very dismissive attitude and, you know, very just basically conservative and completely unshowy. And now, you know, 85, different story. We're seeing that concern is very prominent, unbelievably important. It's a core motivational problem of the organism. And there it is. It's revealed on a daily basis, hourly. Amazing.
It's amazing. My
go ahead.
My sisters and their girlfriends, they like to joke around. They say that when they're of age and in those social circles, they're going to get themselves a life alert button so they can just summon the hot firefighter whenever they want.
Oh my God. Nice strategy.
Very crafty. That's good.
Oh, I mean, as we have this conversation, I can anticipate, you know, getting pushback from, you know, I very frequently hear from women who are, you know, generally over 50, who basically say this doesn't apply. You know, they don't, they're not in this competitive mode, and that they're not interested in what men think of them, and that they're living for other reasons and they're interested in other things. And, and so, you know, of course that is often true. I mean, this is a relative moving target, depending on who you are, kind of how, you know, were you a boy crazy high schooler, then you're probably going to be a boy crazy 85-year-old, you know, like your personality is a reflection of your priority matrix. And so it's probably going to be very consistent over the course of your life. You're not likely to shift, or if other circumstances change and you just find yourself in a different situation. So all of that said, you know, if you're hanging out with your girlfriends, having your red hat lunch, like my grandma did, this is the, when I am an old woman, I shall wear purple poem, for people who are familiar with that. It's kind of a little social group for senior ladies. You know, if Robert Redford had walked in, they, you know, even those most hardened among them to the possibility of flirtation, they may have found themselves a little interested in that. So it's always a dynamic response to your available opportunities and the perceived constraints. It's a dynamic, moving target, and it's going to reflect both your personality and your environmental context at any given moment in time. So people can be in all sorts of different parts of that bell curve throughout their life.
Yep.
Well, in light of what you just said, Dr. Hawk, it was only half of the girlfriends and sisters that said that with a life alert button. The other half just to preserve their reputations. Yeah.
Right. There you go.
Yeah. It's worth saying, because I think sometimes people feel that we're being kind of dismissive of, you know, having other interests outside of this very narrow kind of, like, oh, I only exist to get the most exciting possible mate, and there's no other purpose to my life. And that's really not what we're saying. We're just saying that's kind of that's at the center of the animalistic drive inside of all of us. But the way that it is manifest in any particular individual is obviously a very individual and specific process.
Well, wonderful.
All good.
Thank you, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle. Okay, so the next question is similar topic. Last week I was, or last episode, in an earlier episode, excuse me, I was crushed to hear Dr. Lyle say he is dead from an evolutionary perspective. As an avid follower of Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, and the podcast, this active 75-year-old woman is finished with reproduction, but still desiring social contact and certainly not ready to retreat from the village. I would love to hear you address the social needs of seniors who are open extroverts.
Well, yeah. The truth is that I think Jen just put this, that the creature stays remarkably consistent throughout of its lifespan. And so the and one of the things that our world is not too great at is for various interesting reasons, you see how sort of socially isolated the world is. So we retreat to our houses in our suburbs, and you're watching an interesting cost benefit analysis that so much of the world is more comfortable there than it is, you know, living in a commune in the middle of a big city. So there obviously we have competing demands inside the human nervous system, and literally the physical architecture of how it is that we do live when we have the opportunity to live the way we want is expressing some very, you know, interesting values, dynamics that sit inside of humans, and an awful lot of humans want an awful lot of privacy, which is really interesting. If they don't need the value that they have of being in groups, if you're out in the suburbs and you've got a police force and a fire thing down the street and everybody's orderly and there's plenty of food around. So if you have a famine in your backyard garden that goes south, you know, it's no problem. You got Safeway 2 miles away. In other words, all of these tremendous blessings of civilization, you don't feel like you need to be going to sleep around a big campfire with 30 other people the way you always did in your Stone Age, in the Stone Age village. So what's interesting about that, though, is in the pursuit of that privacy, we also can feel like we've overshot it sometimes, and so people can get a lot of connection in their lives from being in the workplace, for example. If they have large families, they're still connected, but you could also have things change on you. To where suddenly you're not in the workplace, you're not part of some group that's doing something, and now you don't have a place to go every day, and you're 75, and you are living in a suburban type situation, and now you can feel a coalition deficiency and a mate opportunity deficiency and a productive activity deficiency. And so we can see that a lot of those natural sort of social needs are not being served well by the physical architecture of our existence. And so, you know, that's why I forget what they call it. There's a Del Webb is a developer, a brand that has these Del Webb communities, you know, particularly in a lot of areas in the United States. They tend to be in the southern areas where it's warmer, where people want to retire. And some of these things are huge. You know, there might be, I think there's one in South Carolina. I think it is. I think, must be, I don't know, 15,000 people living in one of these things, all with their nice, intermediate size houses. So nobody has to compete with a bunch of money that they've got the biggest house on the block, and they have a tremendous amount of social opportunity, and people feel very comfortable, there because they can live inside of larger coalitions that are mimicking the processes that would have been in the Stone Age. So, yeah, I think that the world has some social psychological needs that are that people struggle with because of the competing demands that people have had across the lifespan have led to a physical architecture of the environment that isn't necessarily ideal for everybody at every age group. And so as the market responds to that and people figure out how to make it look different and better, you know, we'll find solutions that may serve us better. But for now, you know, you can, this is Jen's potted plant you know, find a place like that, for example, that serves your particular interests well, because there probably is somewhere.
Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. Our listeners have not heard already, Dr. Lyle has a end of year show with Chef AJ as well. It's worth mm-hmm. checking out. I recommend that.
I want to hear Jen.
Dr. Hawk, do you
sometimes she just tunes out.
On this. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was working on my knitting again. No, I think all of that is great. I mean, it's definitely, you become more aware of your lack of a social insurance policy as you get older as well. So I think it's an interesting two-way trap, because as people get older, they actually get more discerning about who they want to spend time with. Of course they would, you know, they have more data on how people are likely, how relationships are likely to develop based on who people are. So this is, you know, I am not super introverted. I'm really kind of middle of the bell curve with extroversion, introversion, but I get more introverted with age because I'm just much more discerning about who I'm going to spend time with, because I've built more correlations over time where I see certain kinds of personality traits and behavior early in a potential coalition member. And I'm like, not worth it. I have enough examples of where this goes, that this is not somebody that is going to be a very good CB in the long term. So it pushes me into looking like a more introverted individual. And I think that happens for everybody, including even, you know, high extroverts like this person is identifying. But then at the same time, you're feeling the pressure, you know, at 75 of a diminished coalition just in general. And mm-hmm. particularly if you're in comparably very good health and you're active, that's an interesting set of pressures. So you're kind of like looking for people who qualify as an insurance policy to be there for when you might need them. And if they're going to qualify for an insurance policy, they have to be basically as good as you are, or ideally a little better in terms of their kind of value to the village. Otherwise, why are you going to pay the premium if they're not as good as you are? It's not worth paying the friendship premium to call them in a time of trouble. So it's tough. It's always tough, and it gets tougher as you go through life, and particularly in that age group. So I think definitely the more you can, you know, as we say in a very non-vegan example, fish where the fish are, and create that environment where you're most likely to stumble across people who qualify for coalition members and friendship and mating opportunities, if you're interested, the better off you're going to be.
Wow, Jen, that was fantastic. That you put your finger right on an interesting problem that we know is there but doesn't quite get articulated, which is that this issue of two 40-year-olds that meet, they're both competent enough to drag the other one out of a ditch. And if you get into a ditch, it's unlikely, but now you're in trouble, but your odds of recovering are tremendously high. So if I go to the trouble to drag you out of a ditch, then I've proved my coalition value to you. And so it's worth paying that premium. You're gonna feel how valuable I am. You're going to be a very good coalition member to me in the future. And it was a short-term cost. Whereas that, so I don't have to be looking for people that are better than me when I'm 40, because everybody's in pretty good shape. In other words, they don't have to be a better survival specimen. But boy, at 75, that consideration gets, this is fascinating, Jen. The trade gets harder.
Yeah, there's a lot more pressure. Not just physically, but also, you know, intellectually, problem solving wise. Like, you know, people should think about this in terms of like, I'm looking at you and evaluating you as a potential friend. Like, can you drag me out of a ditch? But also, can you help me figure out how to get out of the ditch? Like, if we're both there and we're both sort of not able to do it, I need some IQ. I need some creativity. I need all of those things that people value in friendship. And so, it gets more and more scarce. These are scarce commodities to begin with, and they get more and more scarce as you narrow the pool.
Wow. This is actually, I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. That's actually, because I've watched it with my mother, who her whole life was an extremely competent person and very agreeable person, and highly conscientious and therefore valuable, and was basically had no problem, always had more people that wanted to be her friend than she had any interest in. So zero friendship deficiency, basically avoided people because she was inherently attractive. I'm not saying physically attractive, but inherently attractive as a coalition member. Very pleasant, right. Capable, easygoing, willing to give you status, in other words, and competent, was not going to bring costs, okay? And I look at her situation now, of course, where she is in a position where she's really not good, anything good to anybody. So she's good to me, for me, to just because I have the memories of her, and it's a joy to watch her laugh or watch her happy. Okay, but I mean, I'm a unique person. She could not now honestly go out there and earn a friendship through her ability to trade as an insurance partner. Could not do so. So she could activate somebody's maternalistic chips by childlike behavior and needy behavior that could serve as a recipient of somebody else's grandstanding of their abilities to the village more broadly. That is true, okay? But that's not much of a position of power. And so this is a really interesting analysis of the problems of the elderly that we sort of know is there, but we can't quite put our finger on it. And I think you've done a great job here. We're gonna be talking more about this. It's important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
good.
Well, Dr. Hawk, yes. Thank you. I mean, you started off 2020 last year, giving us a brilliant explanation about New Year's resolutions and how to achieve those, and you dazzled Dr. Lyle and myself yet again.
Oh my God!
I think she can stay.
No,
with Dr.
I need a
Lyle.
No ego trap sign. You guys are very sweet. This is an ego trap free zone.
Dr. Lyle, not bad for a young one, huh?
That's right. Oh, coming along well. Oh, my goodness. All right. Do we have one more, or are we good?
I think we're good for tonight. The next one's about anxiety without medication. So I think before we open up that can of worms, we'll take a break. So.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds perfect. That's great, Nathan.
All right. Well, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. Welcome to 2021. And let's hope it's a wonderful year. Just a little fun article someone shared on the Facebook group is they thought it was very well written in the style of Dr. Lyle. They said 2020 was the worst year, provided the fact that you didn't live through any other time in history. So.
Right. Well said. I like that.
Very well said. Yeah. Totally.
All right, everybody. Thank you, Nathan.
Talk to you soon. Talk to you guys next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.